Welcome to our podcast series on the management of patients with skin cancer. In this episode, Dr. Mark Taylor, professor of surgery at Dalhousie University, discusses the surgical implications for the treatment of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. Dr. Taylor is a facial plastic and reconstructive surgeon in Halifax, Nova Scotia. His expertise and clinical interests include rhinoplasty or nasal surgery, eyelid surgery, management of facial paralysis, facial skin cancer, facial reconstruction, and surgery of the aging face. This podcast episode is based on a video capsule recorded previously with Dr. Taylor and can be viewed along with the slides by visiting our website at www.impactmedicom.com within the video capsule section. The direct link to the full video capsule can also be found in the episode description. Hope you enjoy it.
Hello, everyone. My name's Mark Taylor. I'm an otolaryngologist, head and neck surgeon in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Dalhousie University. It's great to be with you. I'm going to talk about a surgeon's perspective on the management of cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, something that's near and dear to my heart. I usually like to start off with a quote. This is a quote from an American psychologist called Abraham Maslow. He says, "I suppose it is tempting, if the only tool you have is a hammer, to treat everything as if it were a nail." In the Maritimes, anyway, we tend to say, if you're a hammer, then everything looks like a nail. So as a surgeon, I think historically, as a surgeon, you think of when you see a cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, you think of yourselves as being a hammer and surgery is the nail. And still, I guess, to some extent, that is true, because when I see a new skin cancer patient, I usually am thinking surgery. Why? Because it's tried, tested, and true. All of us on the call who have treated cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, who have done good surgery, good reconstruction, there's really nothing better that you can do for a patient. And it just is a great way to treat it, if it's a possibility. But what other thoughts do I have as a surgeon? I usually think, you know, can I get a clear surgical margin? What would preclude me from doing that? If you look at the most recent AJCC, and this hasn't changed over the last few iterations of it, if there's skull base involvement, obviously, if it's climbing up some of the cranial nerves going through foramina, then that's a problem to get a clear margin. Or if you have invasion into the internal carotid artery. That would certainly give you pause as to doing upfront surgery on these patients. Then I think about what critical structures need to be removed. I think of the old specialty of eye, ear, nose, and throat. I think of the functional deficit. So I think of the eye. Would I have to remove someone's eye? Would I have to remove someone's nose, a complete rhinectomy? And probably lastly, just the ear. So EEN is what I think of. And then the T in my mind stands for thinking about what the functional deficits are going to be. And are there any other options that I could be thinking of in treating this patient? And then lastly, if you're going to do surgery, you're always thinking about how you're ideally going to reconstruct this patient. So here in Halifax and most academic centers in Canada, we have multidisciplinary tumor boards. For our head and neck tumor board site here in Halifax, of course, we have four otolaryngologists, head and neck surgeons. We have three radiation oncologists. We have a few medical oncologists that are involved. A number of radiologists get involved. One thing that we're doing more and more of would be PET imaging of head and neck cancer patients. We have a great head and neck pathologist who's involved. And then we have all the paramedical staff, the nursing staff, the dietitians, the speech language pathologists. And then also, I brought up some of these functional implications of the surgery. We have a maxillofacial prosthetics team who would make artificial noses and ears and orbital prostheses. Although we're always trying to prevent removing someone's eye doing an exoneration, you do see cases like this, especially as a head and neck surgeon. This is a lacrimal gland tumor that is expanding the orbit. So in this case, we don't really have any choice but to remove the eye. And removing the eye, although it's you know, it looks like a very morbid procedure, and it is. Technically, it's a fairly straightforward procedure. You just remove all the contents of the orbit. In this case, it was a little bit of an extended orbital exoneration. And you can see right here, we have some brain exposed. So in this case, we did this as a combined case with neurosurgery, where we did the orbital exoneration and skin excision, and the neurosurgeons did the dural resection and reconstruction with us. In this case, of course, you're going to obliterate the orbit with a big free flap, and we did an anterolateral thigh flap to reconstruct this patient. You can see the dural defect here. So sometimes you just can't get around doing this. This is a big maxillary sinus cancer with extension into the orbit. Quite an extensive surgery, as you can see. So when you're presented with a patient like this, I guess I'm looking at this thinking, like, this isn't really a huge surgery for someone with experience with these other cases to do. So this is a fellow who's had four previous resections of this brow, upper eyelid squamous cell carcinoma. You can see the different scars around here. I think he's had a skin graft. He's had radiation. So you see, in a case like this, I would call this a near miss. So you can see the orbital rim here. Here's the deep temporal fascia, and you can see the orbital fat just coming out of the wound here. So I've actually resected some of the orbital septum. For those of you on the call who are surgeons, you'll know that if a tumor breaches the orbital septum when you're doing periorbital surgery, then you're looking at doing an orbital exoneration. So in this case, that was my deep margin and it was free, so I was okay to leave the orbital contents. The reconstruction here, I've done a lot of these forehead flaps to, I'm basically robbing Peter to pay Paul. So I'm taking skin from the forehead, which isn't a really functionally sensitive area, and transferring it to the eyelid in orbit, where it is obviously functionally quite sensitive. A bigger case here where you can see a resection. I can tell you here, you're looking at the levator aponeurosis. So again, there's usually this orbital septum, which is this fascial band between the orbital rim and the upper eyelid. I've actually resected this as my deep margin and took some of the orbital fat out, which was clear. You can see a fairly large defect, again, a near miss. Now, why do I have this case on here? Because I just saw this fellow back. This tumor was just expanding. It was, again, a cutaneous squamous cell, just rapidly growing. I bumped a patient, did the case in a week, did another forehead flap here. And this is the kind of patient that needs postoperative radiation. So again, that's something that has to go through your thought process. What's going to happen with this patient down the road? Now, surgically, I thought, wow, I did a great job. I took out the orbital septum. I saved his eye and his vision. But what's happening now with this fellow is, after his radiation, he has really bad chemosis and pain. So I may not have actually done him any favors by saving his orbit. Another near miss, a large fungating squamous cell in the temple, necessitating a parotidectomy and neck dissection. Again, you can see the orbital fat emanating from the lower and the upper eyelid. You can see the orbital rim here and the zygoma. You can see how in these cases, you have to take the frontal branch of the facial nerve, and you can see the lower branches here. Again, a near miss. Someone that we try not to remove the orbital contents. Now, if that was going into the orbit, then I think you'd have to have a real long conversation with the patient. We're actually doing a study on this right now at Dalhousie. We're using a utility model to try to see if patients will actually potentially give up a little bit of survival based on keeping, for instance, their eye or the entirety of the nose. Kind of copied that off a laryngeal cancer study that was done in firefighters in the 50s. And what they found there was that firefighters would actually give up some of their life expectancy for treatment if they could save their larynx. So kind of the same thought process dealing with these periorbital cancers. And this is ultimately what we're trying to avoid here. Here's a cutaneous squamous cell cancer of the upper and lower eyelids. And you can see the orbital contents here, the orbital apex, I should say, and all the bone here of the orbit. Everything else is removed. Moving on, I don't think the ear has as much functional implications. And you can see in this patient, just to orient you, there's the eye, there's the temporal scalp. So you can see he's had his whole ear removed. We've drilled out some of the inner ear here, and here's the facial nerve again. Something that we do a lot of at our center are these large facial resections for cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. Some of them are metastatic from old primaries of the skin that go into the parotid. This was actually a primary SCC of the ear, necessitating a total auriculectomy and neck dissection and parotid. Now, these are a lot easier to rehabilitate. You can see here we're doing a supraclavicular flap from the left side of this gentleman's neck and upper extremity. And that's what it looks like when it goes in. Now, what can we do here? We can do an artificial ear down the road. The other thing we can do is a bone-anchored hearing aid, is because we drilled out all the outer ear. So it's really hard to perforate a flap in, you know, at the end of a surgery, something that you can do down the line, but a Baha is something that we offer patients. And then to complete the trifecta of the eye, ear, and nose, this is a really difficult patient from Cape Breton who comes in rapidly growing cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma of the nose. You can see what it looks like when I got him to surgery. Took off the lower half of the nose, some of the upper lip. You can see my plan for reconstruction there. Basically a perialar crescent advancement flap and a forehead flap and some V to Y advancements on the lip. That's what he looks like after. So he looks pretty good. He goes back to Cape Breton and then he shows up a couple years later. And this is what he has. Now, this was before the era of immunotherapy. So in this fella, I didn't really have much choice. I had clear margins. He had no radiation, so we just followed him along. And 2 years later, he shows up with a massive recurrence. So what we had to do is a total rhinectomy here in this case. So again, there's not really much to offer him before the era of immunotherapy. So now we would probably reconsider in this fellow and give him some doses of immunotherapy, some neoadjuvant immunotherapy before contemplating a total rhinectomy. So that's a good segue into this study. I was fortunate to see Dr. Gross speak last week about this study. This was published in the New England Journal. I know a lot of surgeons on the call here probably have reviewed this at some of their respective journal clubs. We certainly have here at Dow in our Odo program. It's something that we wanted all of our residents and fellows to know about. And this is the use of neoadjuvant cemiplimab for stage 2 to 4 cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. So just a little bit about the study design. It was a phase 2 non-randomized multicenter study. It was done in Australia, in Europe, and the United States. So all the patients who were entered had resectable stage 2 and stage 3 and 4 squamous cell carcinoma. So part 1 of the study then was the patients were offered neoadjuvant cemiplimab, as you can see the dose there, 350 milligrams IV for 4 doses. They were imaged before they were started into the treatment arm, and they were imaged after 2 doses, so halfway through their neoadjuvant journey. They then underwent curative intent surgery, and I didn't know this, but this was non-adaptive surgery, i.e., if the patients were seen and the tumor was, say, 5 centimeters and you plan for 1 centimeter margins, the same surgery was done at the time of the curative intent surgery. So there wasn't adaptive minimized surgery on any of these patients, which was something that I just learned last week, but was really important to know. So the primary endpoint then was to look using an independent central pathologic reviewer to see how many of the patients had a complete response rate. So when they had surgery and had their tumor removed, how many patients actually didn't have any cancer left in the specimen? They powered the study at 72 patients. They included 79. The secondary endpoints was a maximum pathologic response. So they did have tumor in the specimen, but it was less than 10% of what was considered the original viable tumor, again, rated independently. So they put these CRs and MPRs together to essentially get a response rate after neoadjuvant cemiplimab. They used the RECIST 1.1 radiologic assessment for overall response rate. I'll talk a little bit more about that. But essentially, they have a nice breakdown of that as well. And I'm not going to talk too much about safety and tolerability as a surgeon, but I think you can see in the study cohort, probably fits a lot of our patient profiles in Canada, a mean age of about 73. Most of the patients were male. Most of them were white. 90% of the cutaneous squamous cells were on the head and neck. The majority were stage 3 and 4 cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. The 5 stage 2 tumors were all greater than 3 centimeters. So they are on the bigger side of stage 2, but they're also in aesthetically or functionally sensitive areas. Most of them had good functional status. The majority, 75%, were ECOG 0. I think this is a remarkable slide here, and I'm going to focus more on the independent pathology review. So the actual complete response rate in the study, 40 out of the 79 patients entered actually had a complete response, so about 50%, which I thought was quite significant, remarkable, and probably a bit of a game changer for a surgeon for a hammer when you think everything looks like a nail. 10 of the patients had an MPR. So again, less than 10% viable tumor, but they did have viable tumor. If you put those together, 50 or 63% of the cohort had either an MPR or a CR. 20 of the patients, or a quarter of them, they were non-responders. And 9 of the patients didn't undergo surgery, so they were not evaluable from a pathologic standpoint. And then looking at the radiologic response, the response rate, the objective response rate, was 68%. 6% had a CR, and 62% had a partial response. I'm going to show you that on a waterfall plot here in just a second. 20% had stable disease. There were 10% with progressive, and one patient wasn't able to be evaluated. So here you can see, using the RECIST criteria, the overall pathologic response, basically comparing that to the radiologic response. So if they had a 20% increase on radiology at that after the two cycles, then that was considered progression. If they had anywhere between a 30% decrease and a 20% increase, that was considered stable disease. Okay, so you can see the majority are actually falling here. So they've had more than a 30% decrease in the size of their cancer based on their radiologic evaluation. And I should note that the radiology changes, or the radiologic changes, they always follow the pathologic changes. So you can see the majority actually had more than a 30% decrease on their evaluation at 2 weeks. And I think that's a real key point. When you talk to medical oncologists who treat a lot of these patients and watch them early on, they usually will be able to tell within 2 doses if they're going to have a response or not, because those that are going to respond tend to respond fairly quickly. So if we break this down a little bit, again, looking at the radiologic response, the 5 patients that had a CR radiologically, they had a 100% complete response pathologically, so no cancer on the specimen. The ones that had a partial response radiologically, those would be the ones that had more than a 30% decrease in the size on their imaging. 38 of them actually had a CR, and 6 of them had no response. So I should say 38 of the 44 had either a CR or an MPR, which would be an overall response rate of 86%. So again, pathologic changes happen faster, obviously, than the radiologic changes. So the 49 patients that either had a complete response or a partial response radiologically, the majority of them don't have any significant cancer in their specimen. The ones that had stable disease, it's about 50-50. About 7 of them had a CR or an MPR, and 9 of them, I'm sorry, were non-responders. And as you'd expect, those with progressive disease on radiologic evaluation, none of them had any type of CR or MPR. So I think that study in the New England Journal really highlights how we have to start thinking a little bit outside the box when we see a patient like this. So this is a patient of mine who had a couple of previous squamous cells removed from the nose. I saw her. She had a through and through defect of the right lateral subunit onto the tip. I did a resection. The margins were all negative. It was a stage four, so we decided to give her postoperative radiation. And she comes in after her radiation, and you can see that she's got a massive recurrence. So, you know, she's had surgery, clear margins, she's had radiotherapy. What else is an option here now for this patient? Really, the only thing that I could think of was you do a tolarinectomy and, you know, bilateral neck dissections, or you try her with immunotherapy. So that's what we did. So I talked to my medical oncology consults, and we got her on some cemiplimab. And this is what happened. The tumor disappeared. The one thing that I find very difficult with these patients is, when do you operate? I just presented this study by Gross, and, you know, the surgery is all planned after four cycles of immunotherapy. But I think on a day-to-day basis, on a practical basis, the hard thing as a surgeon is knowing when to go in and to do surgery, if you should even do so. So she ended up having, I think this was after 11 cycles, so it went away. And we just continued to treat her with immunotherapy, and she's cancer-free in a very difficult case that was resistant to surgery and radiotherapy. So what can I conclude here? Well, one conclusion I have to make is that perhaps we have to think differently when we see these patients. I think immunotherapy is certainly first-line discussion for any of those situations where you have an unresectable cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. But then I think we have to start thinking outside the box. Even with these resectable cancers that are close to cosmetically and functionally sensitive areas, specifically the eye, but also the ear and the nose, I think maybe neoadjuvant cemiplimab has to be on the radar for these patients and something that we need to take into consideration. I think what I've shown with the Gross study, and hopefully it's clear that almost two-thirds of the patients, or 63.3%, actually had a pathologic response rate. As I mentioned, most of those were complete responses, and about a fifth of them were maximal pathologic responses. So I think we do need to give some consideration in advanced cases with these significant functional defects. And as I mentioned, an orbital exoneration or probably a total rhinectomy. So I hope you enjoyed what I had to say. I wanted to run you through the gamut of the difficult situations that you'll encounter with cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. As I mentioned, I think top priority is always, and probably the most difficult cases we encounter are those with post-septal orbital involvement that necessitate orbital exoneration. That's certainly the type of case that I'm going to consider using immunotherapy going forward. A lot of our large ear resections, I find that the patients do fairly well from a functional standpoint. But the other thing that I find challenging as a surgeon is the total rhinectomy patient. I have no problem whatsoever with a hemirhinectomy or even a three-quarter rhinectomy defect. But some of these patients that have very recalcitrant cancers and multiply operated, multiply recurrent, it's something that I'm certainly going to put some thought into whether or not I should be treating them with neoadjuvant cemiplimab before embarking on any further surgery. Again, I want to thank you for your attention, and I hope you have a good day. Thank you.